Good morning.
Good morning.
And good morning. So this morning I'm going to talk about emptiness. I'm going to talk a little bit about emptiness from the Western sense, and then contrast it with emptiness in the Buddhist sense. Okay? Sounds scintillating, doesn't it? So emptiness, in the Western sense, is pretty different from the Buddhist sense, although there are similarities. We think of the 20th century in particular. I think of the 20th century in particular, the literature, the poetry, the philosophy of the 20th century, focusing in the West a lot on emptiness, a lot on Western idea of emptiness, which is lack. The Enlightenment has broken down. This is not the Asian Enlightenment. This is our Enlightenment, our 18th century Enlightenment, when we thought reason, when we thought science, when we thought technology would take care of us. It began to break down in the 20th century. We began to lose our belief. And at the same time, we began to lose our religious beliefs. We began to question our religious beliefs. And so we had all of this literature starting in the 20s about the death of philosophy, the irrational man, irrational woman. And then we had the whole flowering of existentialism, which, if you're as old as me, you remember. But if you're not as old as me, you probably don't know anything about it. Maybe if you're 5 or 10 years younger than me, you know about it. Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, Martin Heidegger, Soren Kierkegaard. Ever hear of any of those guys? And they really wrote about emptiness. They really went to the depths and saw that reason wasn't working, that belief wasn't working, that all of our ideals of the Enlightenment were not working out because we were in war, big time, right? Two huge wars. So where is the Enlightenment? How's the Enlightenment helping us? How's reason helping us? How's religious belief helping us when we're doing this almost annihilation in the two world wars, a potential annihilation of each other? So that's a brief introduction to Western emptiness. We could spend a lot of time on that, because when I was young, I studied that stuff, not for fun, but because I was trying to get a grip on life myself. I was trying to figure out what it was all about myself, so I paid attention to that stuff a lot. But that is Western emptiness, and it shouldn't be confused with Buddhist emptiness. Shouldn't be. Shakyamuni himself experienced that kind of thing at the beginning, we think, according to the myth, when he was 28, when he saw sickness, old age, and death. And when he realized that all of his palatial luxuriance didn't amount to much, and that he wasn't happy, and we could say he experienced some existential emptiness from the Western point of view then. But in addition to seeing the aged person, the sick person, the dying person, he saw the sannyasin. He saw the holy person who seemed to be dwelling in stillness, just dwelling in stillness. So even though he was feeling an existential angst himself, he said, I'm going to follow this path and see if there's something beyond this. But there are similarities between existential emptiness and Buddhist emptiness. One is that they both say reason can only go so far. Reason and belief can only take us. Reason can only take us so far, and belief can only take us so far. Ultimately, reason is going to fail us at some point because the world doesn't adhere to the well-thought-out plans. It doesn't adhere to that. And our beliefs are going to fail us when something awful happens. It's counter to our idea of a gentle God or a loving God. So the limits of reason and belief, and also humor. Humor. Both of them stress humor. Very interesting. Very interesting. If you ever saw any of the plays or read any of the plays by Beckett, Waiting for Godot, the most famous, or Ionesco, The Rhinoceros. I don't know if they still do this stuff. When I was young, these plays were all over the place. Humor. Great humor. Humor about the absurdity of life and how we get caught on our ideas about how life should be. But for Ionesco and Beckett, there's underlying that humor, there's a sense of tragedy. A sense of real tragedy. That we can't know anything, we don't know anything, and we might as well just laugh about it. We might as well just be Charlie Chaplin about it. Charlie Chaplin's very sad too. But where is Buddhist humor? The Chan masters, the Zen masters in China, they also laugh, but they laugh from the pit of their stomachs. They laugh about life and death and the limits of reason. They laugh from what we call the Buddhist emptiness. And then attachment. They both, the existentialists and, at least not all the existentialists, but many of the existentialists, and of course us Buddhists, we emphasize that we don't need to be attached to all this stuff. And the first book I read by Albert Camus, The Stranger, anybody else read that book, The Stranger? A few of you older people. I'm sure it's around still. We still must teach this stuff someplace. So it starts with his mother dying, Albert Camus' mother dying. And he goes to her funeral. And he has a sense of real detachment while he's there watching. He sees the tears forming in the eyes of someone in the front row. And he watches the tears as they form in the eyes and then as they go down the cheek and as they go off the chin. And he looks around and he's totally, totally detached. So that's, it seems like a little bit like Buddhist detachment, like mindfulness. There you are, you're just with the tear. You're just watching the tear, you're not judging. But then if you really read The Stranger, he's given up. He's just given up. He's given up on everything. His detachment comes from some sense of futility, but beyond futility to hopelessness. And that's not Buddhist detachment. That's not Buddhist detachment. But it seems kind of similar. So that's the Western sense of emptiness. And the Buddhist sense of emptiness, the Mahayana Buddhists, because this is Mahayana Buddhism that we practice here. The Mahayana Buddhist sense of emptiness, the term is shunyata, right? Shunyata etymologically means pregnant. Pregnant. That's what it means. Pregnant with all of life. Ready to give birth at every moment. You don't know what you're going to give birth to, but it's coming. It's coming out. There's a chance to enjoy it, to appreciate it. It's completely empty, giving birth. I never had a chance to give birth like some of you guys did. And I know that it was agonizing at first, but then when you actually did it, wow, when my wife did it, when my daughter did it, wow. So the four kinds of emptiness in in Mahayana Buddhism. First I'll use the Sanskrit words and then I won't talk about them anymore because I don't. Okay, so the first one is samskrta shunyata. The second one is asamskrta shunyata. The third one is maha shunyata. And the fourth one is shunyata shunyata. Okay, so I will go through them. And there will be no test. Because there's no need to remember any of this. Unless you're going to be a Buddhist teacher. And you have to remember all of it. So you can help other people, right? You can help other people. Samskrta shunyata, that comes from samskara, which I've been talking a lot about in my talks lately. Samskara. Our samskaras is when we make something out of our immediate experience. Sam, together, skara, maker. We make something out of our immediate experience. We have a desire, we have a storyline, we make something out of it. So this one says that that's empty. That's empty. That we can be free from those storylines. We can be free from those desires when we see their emptiness. Emptiness in terms of vacancy, of openness, letting them come and go without being hypnotized by them. So last time I talked about, last talk I gave, which I think was 2 weeks ago, I talked about my friend who came from California to be with her mother here. And her mother is about 70 and my friend's probably late 40s. And she came at a time when her mother was ready to deal with stuff, was ready to listen to my friend's issues about her. And this was an opportunity. Because even though my friend had been practicing Zazen for a long time, still those issues keep coming up. They keep coming up. And here, her mother was open to hearing about them. Well, then, if you remember what I said before, a couple weeks before she left, what happened? Her mother had a stroke. Her mother had a stroke. And so she came out anyway. She came out anyway. And her mother didn't seem to have lost her receptive communication skills, but could only talk in like one or two words at a time. So my friend was able to somehow or other just let go of the samskaras, just let go of her samskaras. Her, even though she was coming out with a specific intention, she was able to let go of that and just be with her. Just drop that resentment. Just drop that those expectations and just be with her. For one thing, it was kind of an emergency. Sometimes in an emergency, we're able to let go of stuff better. Do you know? Have you noticed that? Katagiri Roshi used to talk about emergency case. So if you really have an emergency case, then you have a chance to touch emptiness because you let go. But that doesn't always happen. Sometimes you freak out, right? But she had the Zazen that she'd been doing for, I don't know, 10, 15 years. Sometimes we think that Zazen, that meditation we're doing, really isn't helping us any. But then something like this happens, and oh, we have some strength to just be with what is and let go. My friend could have reverted to what? An existential emptiness, right? Oh, just hopelessness. God, I've been waiting all these years. How could she do this to me? Or how could God do this? Well, there's no God. How could Buddha do this to me? It could have happened. But at a pivotal point, she was able just to let go. Which reminds me of this poem, which I used once before in a talk I gave a couple months ago by Kenneth Cook about serious moments. first few lines. A serious moment for the water is when it boils. And though one usually regards it merely as a convenience to have the boiling water available for bath or table, occasionally there is someone around who understands the importance of this moment for the water. Maybe a saint, maybe a poet, maybe a crazy man, or just someone temporarily disturbed, with his mind floating, in a sense, away from his deepest personal concerns to more unreal things, like shunyata. A lot of poetry can come from perceptions of this kind, as well as a lot of insane conversations. Well, if you read and talk about the Heart Sutra, which is the Emptiness Sutra, it seems pretty insane. But it's wonderfully insane. It's liberatingly insane rather than hopelessly insane. So that's the first kind, samskirta shunyata, the emptiness of making something out of things. And then the other side is asamskirta shunyata. So always in these emptiness teachings, we do one side and then we say, do the other side. The poor existentialists that just... just drove them into some hopelessness. But for us, it's great. It's the ultimate in resiliency. You can discover this yourself. Don't believe me. So asamskirta shunyata means, samskirta shunyata, we're letting go of our story. We're letting go of our intentions. We're letting go of our desires. That's great, but here she is in Minnesota. She's come all the way from California. She has to develop a new intention if she's going to help her mother. She has to have new desires if she's going to help her mother. She has to develop even a new story, a new vision about how she's going to help her mother. She signed up to come for 2 weeks. She thought they could do this therapeutic stuff and she could get back to California, right? That's what we always think. But then what happens?
Life.
Life. Life intervenes. So she was able to. Develop an intention for the short time that she was going to be here. Extend her trip a little bit. Work with her dad, who has been completely dependent on her mom and had physical health problems of his own. And come back to that intention. That new intention and that new storyline. Human beings, we are storytellers. We are storytellers. And if you think Zen is getting rid of telling stories... That's getting rid of your humanness. That's getting rid of your humanness. But if we can learn to match our stories to what is, rather than what happened 5 years ago or 50 years ago, then our stories can help us really live in emptiness, really live in stillness. So... the third kind of emptiness is then just great. Maha. They always say maha. Just great emptiness. So great emptiness means the ability to both let go of our storyline, let go of our intention, and then develop new, more suitable, more resonant intentions that resonate with what is rather than what we wish had been or might have been or should have been. Or should be. There she is with this woman who can't speak to her like her mother did anymore. She can't speak to her in that way. And this is what she'd been waiting for, finally to have this conversation. She looks like her mother. She smells like her mother. She dresses herself still like her mother. So, but she was ready for it. She was ready. And the Zazen mind is always ready. It's always ready. It's because it's completely empty. Mahashunyata. So when we think of emptiness in Buddhism, we think in particular of negating things, the negation of the negation of the negation of the negation. And you could go over to Dharma Fields and spend a year on Nagarjuna, negating the negation of the negation of the negation. And you know, we chant this Heart Sutra here every morning. There is no form, no sensation, no perception, no formation, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears. Well, it goes on for a while. And then we get to no suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path, no knowledge, and no attainment. And this is the shortest form of the Prajnaparamitas sutras. There's the 30,000 line one and the 8,000 line one. A lot to negate, right? Well, you're negating the negation over and over and over again. It seems a little bit like Beckett or Ionesco, doesn't it? But there's great joy in this release. Great joy. Great joy. If Camus had run into some bodhisattva who had told him about Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, he might have gone a different direction. Maybe if in a Parisian cafe, if one of those Japanese Zen teachers had been hanging out, what would have happened to the existential movement? What would have happened? For me, when I began practicing Zen, I was in a funk. I was in an existential funk. I mean, you can only, and of course, if you keep reading these guys over and over again, it does not help your funk. To think, maybe that's why people don't read them so much anymore. And then I met a teacher. So Buddha, I met a teacher, and I was a little bit naive, but he seemed so alive and so ready that I just said, I'm going to do this. So we talk about Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We can fall into this negativity anytime. We can fall into this Western emptiness anytime. We need Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to help us. And it can happen before we begin practicing, or after you've been practicing for 5 years or 10 years. Hi, come on in. I'll pause. I know it was hard to get here this morning because of the runners. It can happen after you've been sitting for a long, long time and you've had wonderful experiences of so-called emptiness, so-called spaciousness. I've talked before about being here in this building, actually, and learning that my brother had killed himself. And I went right into one of those Camusian, Sartrean things, right? Oh, God! But I had my sitting practice. I had my sitting practice. And I just stayed with my sitting practice. Dealt with all the pain. I should have also reached out to Buddha and Sangha, but I didn't. If you could just reach out to one of the three, it's good enough. In the beginning, my first time I was in that huge funk, I just reached out to Suzuki Roshi as my teacher. The second time I was in a huge funk, I was, you know, I only had one brother. He was 10 years younger than me. I felt responsible for him. I felt like I'd abandoned him. You know, all that stuff, right? et cetera. But I didn't go to Katagiri Roshi because I was ashamed. In those days, we were ashamed. Well, we still get ashamed. But there was even more stigma in those days about something like that. But I had my sitting. And my Sangha, I didn't even want to talk to people here about it. I just had But, you know, Sangha can be just two people. I had one person to talk with about it that I felt I could trust. That was my Sangha. You need one person, and that's your Sangha. If you can find one person, so Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, so that we can get out of that existential funk that comes at any time and return to our natural shunyata, our natural pregnancy, which is giving birth always to something unexpected and alive and wonderful. Wonderful. So the Heart Sutra. Yes. The Prajnaparamita Sutras are all about emptiness. These are the earliest Mahayana Sutras, and they're the ones that articulate it the most. But one interesting thing about the Heart Sutra, for those of you who chant it, is that there's another side to the Heart Sutra, another side to emptiness that the Heart Sutra manifests. And that's the more devotional side, the more even worshipful side. Devotional, worshipful. And this is kind of paradoxical because we're stripping everything away, but at the same time, Prajnaparamita is what? Prajna means wisdom. Paramita means it's gone beyond. It's gone beyond all those views. It shed them all. But Prajnaparamita also appears in early Mahayana Buddhism and throughout the course of Mahayana Buddhism as a goddess, right? The goddess of emptiness. And so the devotional part of Prajnaparamita is, well, why when we recite the Heart Sutra do we actually bow, right? What's there to bow to? It's all neti neti in Sanskrit. Not this, not this, not this. What are we bowing? We're bowing to Prajnaparamita. We're bowing, and I know this is not, people think this is very un-Buddhist, but sorry. We're bowing to the mother of the universe, to emptiness herself, who gives birth to emptiness in our hearts when we give ourselves away to her. And my teacher's teacher, my first teacher's teacher, had calluses on his forehead. You know why he had calluses on his forehead? Huh? Yeah, to the floor. Yeah, I guess they had nothing soft about. I guess they just did it on the hardwood floor. So this is the devotional side. And I didn't mention this to my friend because my friend, she's a Zazen practitioner. And the mythology of Prajnaparamita doesn't appeal to her. And she's in the Jokobek lineage. Do you know about the Jokobek lineage? The Jokobek lineage is kind of really poo-poos the devotional side. It says, just strip it away, just strip it away, just strip it away, strip, strip. You get in the devotional side, you're creating a deity, and then you get hooked on that deity and dependent on that deity. So I didn't mention it to her. And if you go to Dharma Fields, a few blocks from here, you'll see that Steve Hagen is very much the strip it away, strip it away, strip it away. And on Sunday, there is no bowing here. So, but if you come in the morning, you'll do bowing with this. I mean full-length bowing to the floor. So devotion to the Great Mother, to the Great Mother emptiness. And there was a Zen teacher here named Diane Benaj a few years ago. And Diane is really into the devotional side of Buddhism, of Zen. And partly because she lived in a Zen monastery for a while where instead of doing Zazen, they just chanted all day. They just chanted and bowed all day. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. So we have this interesting sort of paradoxical amalgamation in the Heart Sutra. And, you know, either is fine. Either is fine. Both are fine too. And you may have a proclivity to do more of the stripping away, or you may have the proclivity to do the giving yourself away. Or you may like to do both, as I do. As I do. But it's not better to do both. It's all about returning to stillness, returning to that pregnant emptiness. So, Prajnaparamita, in this devotional way, gives birth to Shunyata in our own lives. She lets go of her desires through giving, and then we're able to do the same. So my friend, she ended up mothering her mother. She stayed a whole 2 months and just mothered her. Her mother had never mothered her. She was pissed when she was in California. That's what she wanted to talk to her mother about. But she got here. And she mothered her mother. She mothered her mother for 2 months. And we have that capacity. We all do. That's shunyata. And you can say the goddess or not goddess. I don't care. I didn't mention it to her because I knew she would think it was schmaltzy. That's okay. That's okay. And we have the last shunyata, which is, of course, shunyata, right? It's vitally important to be empty of emptiness, to be completely empty of emptiness. So there's a story about a monk who was named Shunyata. And you know, in this tradition, when you work with a teacher and you become initiated, initiation to be on the road to be a teacher, or initiation which is called lay initiation, which I'm doing this fall with some people, you get a name. So this guy had been given the name Shunyata by his teacher, who saw that his zazen was really, he was really empty in zazen, and in his daily life he could do that. So his teacher gave him that name, and he was called Shunyata. He was a little embarrassed about it, but that's okay. You get used to these names. I've always been a little embarrassed about my name, too. Because usually you see they're really positive names. They were negative names. If we had Camus give the names, we'd have a whole different type of name, right? So his name was Shunyata. And so the story goes that when Shunyata was practicing zazen, and he really let go and just opened up, that the gods rained flowers down on him. And then when he did extend to that in his life, the gods rained flowers down on him. And he said to the gods, even though there are no gods in Buddhism, he said to the gods, how could you discover and rain flowers down on me when I am in emptiness? And then they rain more flowers down. Well, of course, the Chinese Zen masters took this story and they said, that Shunyata, he has the stink of Zen. Don't have anything to do with him. He doesn't know about the emptiness of Shunyata. So my friend was a little awed by what she had done. And I was awed, too. We were a little awed. But that awe only takes us so far. At some point, we just have to come back to making the speech therapy appointments, which she was doing. Figuring out how to take her mom to the grocery store, and then her mom was going to get groceries when she left. How to, again and again, go over the same things with her mom, because her mom was so slow in relearning. With no trace of anything to be in awe about, any emptiness, just to be it, just to do it. So, finishing then with another quote from Kenneth Cook later in his poem. Once the water is boiling, the heater has a choice to look at it and let it boil and go on seeing what it does, or to take it off and use the water for tea, chocolate, or coffee, or beef consomme. You don't drink the product then until the water has ceased to boil, for otherwise it would burn your tongue. So, emptiness is wonderful, but it can burn your tongue. And ultimately, this Zen practice, this life, is nothing more than making coffee and tea and beef consomme and passing it around, giving the beef consomme to the right person, because we pay attention, and the coffee to the right person, and giving some to ourselves to sustain ourselves. And there's no trace of emptiness. There's no trace of shunyata. And sometimes we're down, and sometimes we're up, and sometimes we're in between, but we're just here with it. Just compassionately here with it. And later he says something about compassion in his poem. He ends the poem. The water boils almost every time the same old way, and still it is serious because it is boiling. Those serious times in our life when there's a potential for either transformation or just regressing to pissing and moaning are always there. The potential for the water to boil is always there. And still it is serious because it is boiling. That is what I think one should see. From this may come compassion. It may come, the compassion. It may just come out the way Prajnaparamita gives birth. You yourself giving birth, moment after moment. Okay, I think I'll entertain. Yeah. Sure.
Story, the whole story of Albert Camus' life.
Oh.
But I want to say something that I've seen about him.
Oh, okay. Speak up so they can hear you.
Okay. I just said I don't know the whole story of Albert Camus' life, so I can't say exactly what I'm going to say now.
Yeah.
To the whole story about him.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I thought, uh-huh. How you described that he was detached from everything around.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes you can have that experience of complete detachment, but then you find, you take another step and you find something that's wonderful that is there.
That's true. That's a very good point.
I don't know what happened in his life, but there is this kind of fundamental giving up that can happen
in his life. And both... Both Heidegger, I didn't know about Camus, but both Heidegger and Kierkegaard actually talked about that too. Sartre, not so much. Sartre was like, you have the freedom to say no. That was about Sartre. You have the freedom to say no. But Heidegger talked about how you can move to being in the world, moving from I think, therefore I am, to being in the world. And when he used being in the world, and the translation of the German is being dash in dash the dash world. So it's one process. So it's one whole.
And he also said that being comes from and returns to something that you can't really get at.
That's right. That's right. And Kierkegaard also, but Kierkegaard always had I think Heidegger is the best example and the closest to Zen, because Kierkegaard always had sort of there's anxiety always, although he did talk about touching something. Well, that's good. I'm really glad you brought that up. See, I oversimplified, but when you look at the course of Camus' life, it was still, from what I remember, I haven't read Camus lately, it's still pretty negative for the most part. Heidegger, not so much so. But then Heidegger got in with the Germans, and there's a lot of controversy about whether he was a Nazi or not.
Right.
So,
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, sure.
I have been reading lectures that Tirado Roshi gave many, many years ago. I don't know where. Translated in English. And he makes a distinction between nothingness and emptiness. And he has two different words. One is mu and one is ku in Japanese. And,
well, mu, I don't know, ku, K-U? Okay, well, usually in the usual word for emptiness in Japanese is, or for nothingness in Japanese, excuse me, is mu, which is a chant, this is what I remember, a translation of a Chinese word called wu, which means no thingness. And does the dog have Buddha nature? And the answer is mu, no thing. So that's about a... That's about what I know about that. I don't know about that. But no thing, if you really see no thing, if you really become no thing, if you do a mukon, I don't know if you guys are with me on this, but mukon is where you sit down and you think about, mu, 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 does the dog have Buddha nature? It's ridiculous, right? But then you try to become mu, and the Rinzai teachers will say, if you become mu, the bottom drop out. And when the bottom drop out, Shunyas ha. Mu, no trace of mu. Everything mu. So, the ku, I don't know anything about it. Yeah?
A couple of things. One, just sort of a comment about the enlightenment and how that's falling apart or has fallen apart and it's existentialism and I think there was, in Leonard Cohen's words, a crack where the light may get in. In corporate America, in Fortune magazine, which is a big corporate magazine, there was an article in there about CEOs doing 10-day Vipassana sits. Insight out of Barry, a Shelburne Falls. So, some, you know, that's intense stuff.
Fairly recently?
Yeah, it was just last week with Bill Gates on the cover.
Uh-huh.
Not that he's doing it, but it's the one with him on cover. And it's a very good article.
Uh-huh.
Who wrote it. And they listed... Barry, Shelburne Falls, and then Cornfield's Place, Spirit Rock in California.
Huh?
So
great.
It's hopefully going to get some lights going to get in there. Second one is with respect to what you said about the, and I want to just clarify with the give up Zen. That's where you had with the person whose name is Shinya, I believe, and
right.
You have to give up Zen. And
right.
I did a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, and he, I remember somebody asked a question, something like that, and he said, I deal with a lot of people who are attached to things, and that I can deal with. But those who are attached to non-attachment, very difficult.
Uh-huh.
And he just left it at that.
Uh-huh.
Powerful.
Yeah.
Thing. Is that kind of what
you're... Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, you got it. You got it. And that can happen in many different forms.
Oh, yes.
That can be an intellectual attachment. That can be kind of a blissful,
yes.
You know, wow. Ooh, this machine, everything cleared out.
Yeah.
Wow, look at me, you know. Linda, just, you know, make the dinner and don't deal with this. Don't bother me, you know.
I'm an enlightenment.
Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit to the masculine, feminine, and the Western existentialist? I don't know, feminine, Western...
Well, I can speak to that, but not very much.
I guess my question is because you refer to the great emptiness as a mother.
Yeah, that's how they refer to it in all the literature. That's because in emptiness is interconnectedness. Even Nagarjuna, who strips everything away, says that what you end up with is seamless web of interdependence, and not your idea of it. And so that can only come from the maternal side, because the maternal side feels that connection always, at some level.
So maybe we should have a woman present.
Maybe we should. I'll read you a few more quotes. I'll read you some quotes from the long Prajnaparamita Sutra that will give you a little... a sense about Prajnaparamita as the mother, as the great mother. Prajnaparamita is often depicted in art as being white or yellow in color, with anything from 2 to 12 arms, some in a various mudra positions, usually in a teaching mudra, holding a lotus, the sacred book, a sword to cleave away ignorance, a thunderbolt symbolizing the emptiness of the void, and a begging bowl renunciating material goods. So if we were in a devotional temple, a devotional Buddhist temple like Diane stayed in, we'd have a prajnaparamita here on the altar. And then, of course, the Tibetans take prajnaparamita and they turn her into the goddess Tara. If you do Tibetan Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism is full of deities. And they have the goddess Tara, 16-year-old innocent. But in that innocence, she also gives birth to everything. But she looks different from prajnaparamita. And prajnaparamita, Shariputra says to Buddha in one of the long prajnaparamita sutras, the perfection of wisdom shines forth as a sublime light. Buddha nature, I sing the spontaneous hymn of light to praise Mother Prajnaparamita. She's utterly unstained because nothing in this insubstantial world can possibly stain her. She is an ever-flowing fountain of incomparable light from every conscious being on every plane. She removes the faintest trace of illusion, darkness. In her alone we can find refuge. On and on. On and on. And then at the end, Shariputra says to Buddha, she's the perfect wisdom of birthless birth to all Buddhas. And through these sublimely awakened ones, it is the Prajnaparamita alone who turns the wheel of true teaching. And Buddha says, precisely so, beloved Shariputra. And so, I never remember Buddha calling Shariputra beloved, except in this case when there's the maternal is sort of being played out here. Anyway, we could study these long sutras sometime if you want. Or not. Or not. Yes,
so,
Susan.
You said that the devotional was giving yourself away.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so, thinking about that, devotional and giving yourself away and being devoted, just when you were talking about that with your friend, she was completely devoted to her mother and the care.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to me, it's two sides of the coin. We can think about the bowing and this and that, but what does devotional really mean?
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean giving ourselves away?
Yes.
And is that how we're living?
Yes. Yes, so in a way, and Katagiri Roshi used to talk a lot about just devoting yourself to this activity, whatever this activity is. And that was all Zen practice was, with that devotion to this activity, regardless. Uh-huh. Yeah. So then Prajnaparamita is something extra, but we human beings need something extra to encourage us. Sometimes.
What might Zen say of the whole
"you create your own reality" camp? Can you say that a little louder?
Yeah. What might Zen say about the whole camp of "you create your own reality"?
So she's saying, what would Zen say about the whole idea that you create your own reality? Yes. Yes.
Well, because that's more of a. I mean, does that go against the whole accepting things as they are?
Well, no. No, let's go back to my friend. So she had created a reality, which was legitimate, that her mother had not been there for her when she was a child, and that her mother was finally opening to have this dialogue. Wow. Here they are. She's 48 and her mother's 70. To talk about it, to work it through so they could be close. But she had created this reality. She'd been carrying around with her. Then she got here, she just had to drop that reality. She didn't have to, but she wanted to. She was a bodhisattva, so she was able to. And partly because of her affection for this woman who gave birth to her. And partly because of her Zazen practice. Then she created a new reality. She had to. Well, I'm only going to be here for a month. I have to create a new reality. How is mom going to live? How is dad going to live? How are they going to communicate if she can't talk to him? Can I order speech therapy twice a week? How's that going to compare? How far is that going to go? She had to, how much can I do in 4 weeks? She created another reality. Well, then something happens, and that if we're strong, that reality goes because the situation changes, life changes. I don't know what the next chapter is in this story because it's just happened. But there's going to be another chapter, and we can either let go of that and just return to emptiness and wait for the next reality to be created, or we can make a federal case out of it, which we usually do, right?
So then how much of that is her reality versus just a new reality presents itself? You know,
that's right, but she's... Yes, a new reality presents itself, but she still has to use her fantasy life. She has to use her thinking. She has to use her emotions to visualize. We have to do this. This is a unique aspect of human beings. We have an opportunity to do this, to see how the world can be better, how we can be more safe in the world and others can be more safe in the world. So that is our fantasy in a way. I'm using that positive in a positive way, but it should be based on what we see and hear rather than just on what we remember. If it's not based on what we see and hear, the samskara is the fourth of the fifth components of the person, five components of the personality. But first we have the physical, the sensation, the feeling, and that's. And if the samskara doesn't pay attention to that, the physical, the sensation, the feeling, then it's just tripped out. That makes sense?
Tim, I have a question for you.
Sure.
A couple weeks ago I mentioned that I felt that emptiness that, like you were talking about Camus and detachment when I found out my mother had died.
Uh-huh.
Forget about emptiness. Yet you come back to it, and sitting here this morning I was thinking about emptiness, and it occurred to me that being here in this moment, things, Zazen becomes a total, you know, I'm stuck on mountains are mountains and then mountains are not mountains and then mountains are mountains. That's where I'm at with it, because emptiness was emptiness, but it's taken on a whole new and then Zazen becomes a different tool now.
Good.
With it.
Good.
And something you said, and I'm trying to put it in that perspective because it's just kind of like all washing over me, because you also talked about, I listened to a tape of yours on the parable with the goat cart, the ox cart, and the deer cart.
Yeah.
And those, and using those, and those not being enough, too.
Mm-hmm.
So then we got to come back to emptiness.
That's right. And we don't have to do anything. This is an opportunity we have. We have an opportunity.
And I like that part about every moment is pregnant. It's when you come back.
And there are going to be some stillbirths. That's okay. That's the way we're programmed. There are going to be stillbirths. But we have to... We want to, as bodhisattvas, allow the possibility to give birth at any moment, alive or dead. Alive or dead. Thank you.